You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The FDA recently approved a new drug for Alzheimer's, but many in the medical field say that was a mistake. We'll dig into the controversy and other treatment options in the works coming up. Now, a drought is raging in the western U.S. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, conditions haven't been this extreme in at least two decades. California, Nevada, Arizona, and other southwestern states aren't the only ones with droughts. Wisconsin is experiencing abnormally dry conditions for this time in the season, especially the southeastern part of the state, where the U.S. Drought Monitor issued a severe drought condition. We're talking about droughts now in the western U.S. and here in the state, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you are affected by drought here in Wisconsin, what's that looking like in your part of the state? Are you in one of the communities that's asked people to cut down on water use? Are you a farmer? How are things going for you right now? If you're listening to us in the heavily drought-affected areas of the western United States, love to hear a firsthand report from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's great to be with you again.
Let's start closer to home here, John. We're not as bad as the West Coast, as the Southwest right now, but can you talk about what we're seeing in terms of drought conditions in the state?
Sure. Well, right now, it's mainly in the southern half of the state where drought is in place, generally from, say, Manitowoc County to Juneau and Adams counties to near River Falls. But much of northern Wisconsin is also abnormally dry, but not quite in drought yet. And this is really our first widespread area of drought in Wisconsin in 6 years since the spring of 2015. The drought basically extends into much of lower Michigan and then westward into Minnesota, northern Iowa, and then reaches exceptional levels in parts of the Dakotas.
What is driving this drought? I know not enough rain is a big part of the story, but can you talk about some of the reasons for that?
Well, basically, this has really kind of kicked into gear over the last 4 weeks, but it's had its origins from a pretty dry spring. And what happened is we've get these persistent domes of high pressure aloft. You might have seen them somewhere in online referred to as heat domes, this area of bubble of high pressure that basically diverts the jet stream away from Wisconsin and parts of the upper Midwest. And when that happens, you don't have weather systems coming through with rain and thunderstorms. Instead, we just get the hot, dry part of that for the most part. And that persistent heat dome has been in place over much of the northern U.S. Since about the middle of May. And that's why we've been so dry.
Let's bring on a caller with a report at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Nina. Rick, hi.
How's it going?
All right. What are you seeing out there, Rick?
Well, I just got back from a four-day paddle of the Wisconsin River. We got in Spring Green and got out on the Mississippi. It was 71 miles, and it was much more difficult than I anticipated because of the lack of flow that river would typically have this time of year.
Was it a hard paddling? Did you hit shallow spots, or you just didn't have that impetus from the current that you usually would?
Well, it was all of that. So there was lots of shallow spots where you'd get stuck on the sandbars that you normally wouldn't have, and then the current wasn't there. So when you got your kayak loaded up with 4 days of gear, you're sitting fairly low in the water. So doing 71 miles in 4 days on that river was a beast.
All right. Well, drink some water now, Rick. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. John, Rick is seeing visible impact. And I know we're, again, not at a horrific drought stage, but are there other things that we're watching, we're worried about with the impact of this drought?
Yeah, I can attest to what Rick said here in Waukesha County, Wisconsin. I have a very small river that goes through the village that I live in, and it's barely ankle deep now in the village, and that's way low. And you can see all sorts of mud on the riverbanks, and so we're seeing it in southeast Wisconsin, south central Wisconsin, and at least right now we're dry, but we're not critical yet. I think the next couple of months will be critical. If we can get the normal rainfall back in July and then into August, I think we can head off the worst of this drought.
Right. When I see agronomists reporting on this, they're saying not a crisis yet, at least for farmers in the affected area. Is there any sign that we might get some more rain in those weeks and months to come?
Well, if you'd like, I can start in the near term. There's
sure,
some
and I know that's the easiest to predict.
Exactly. Well, there's some good news. Thursday and Thursday night, it looks like we'll have our next chance of scattered thunderstorms. But, you know, it's scattered. So this is the problem we bump up to in summertime is sometimes the precipitation will be scattered. You know, we saw some scattered thunderstorms over the past weekend that, you know, didn't hit me, not complaining, but didn't hit me, hit everybody around me, didn't hit me. So there will be places where that'll get rain and some places that won't. That's the scattered nature of it. Then there's another chance of scattered storms. I'm sorry to say on Father's Day, but again, we kind of need the rain. And the question will be whether we get a wetter pattern set up by maybe later next week. The kind that gets these thunderstorm clusters that form, the one that dump heavy rain at night, that can produce a lot of lightning. Those are the type of thunderstorm clusters that we really need to snap out of this drought.
And as far as our personal behavior here, I see a lot of the state, again, the same part of the state we're talking about with drought, high fire danger. This chemical plant explosion in Illinois, one of the problems is, I guess, debris is starting little brush fires in the really dry surrounding areas. This is a good time to be really careful about starting fires, right, John?
Absolutely, 100%. I know everybody's going out camping. I know everybody wants to hit the state parks and state forest land. But especially if it's windy, and especially in southern Wisconsin where there's drought concerns, you really need to heed any orders from say your forest ranger, or if there's any red flag warnings put out by the National Weather Service. Don't burn, and you know, make sure your fire is completely out if you're going to set one in a fire pit, because if it's a windy day, obviously those embers can be blown off and can start fires in this very dry vegetation.
We're talking about drought in Wisconsin and in the American West, the Southwest in particular. John Erdmans is with us, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about these droughts or you want to give us a report on what you're seeing in your backyard, your local waterway, your field. And if you happen to be listening online in the Southwest, love to hear what you're seeing there. 800-642-1234 is the number. 800-642-1234. John, let's look west now. I mean, just looking at the maps, this seems like a pretty big area covered by severe drought. What's going on out there?
Yeah, it's just a whole other level out west right now. You know, this is the most widespread drought in the western U.S. this century. And again, if you look at it, if you just Google drought monitor and this map will come up and you look at it, and it's the worst category of drought covering almost the entire desert southwest, much of California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and western Colorado. And this is the problem when you have distinct wet and dry seasons. So in California, they've just gone through their second straight dry, rainy season. So they get most of their rain and mountain snow from, say, November through April. Well, if that doesn't happen, then you've got a problem. Then you're going through the next 6 months of the dry season, and it's already dry. And then they're hoping and praying for a much wetter next winter, so next November through April. So this is the problem that they're facing right now. Not a lot of snowpack to melt and recharge reservoirs. And now you're just going through an extended dry season until the winter snows return.
And heat waves now, too. I imagine that can help. A lot of places with triple digit temperatures, I think even some up to 120. Did I see how much worse does that make a big drought like this?
Well, dry soil heats up much faster than wet soil because the sun's energy goes directly into heating the ground and the air above it. If you have wet soil, it goes into evaporating moisture from lakes and rivers and then drawing moisture out of vegetation. So when the soil is already dry, it heats up much faster. And so that's a contributing factor of what we're seeing right now. We had temperatures already over 100 degrees before noon in parts of Montana and Wyoming today. And in Death Valley, California, if you've ever been there, it's the hottest place in the U.S. We're expecting high temperatures to reach around 126 degrees Wednesday and Thursday, which is about as hot as they get in a typical year.
Let's go back to our callers now. Gene is with us in Rhinelander. Gene, hi.
Hi there. I'm in Rhinelander right now, but I have a home in New Mexico, and because of the pandemic, I did not come to Wisconsin last year. The comment I have is that the drought in New Mexico is unbelievable. Last summer, you know, the summertime is their monsoon season. So we were expecting to experience the monsoon, which never came. We got some, you know, there were some thunderstorms, a lot of clouds and lightning, and then 10 drops would fall. It was dry all winter, and now it continues. In fact, I don't think there's a drop of rain that has fallen on at least southern New Mexico in months. And there's a lot of agriculture there. So it is dire.
Gene, thanks a lot for sharing your experiences there. John, a lot of people waiting for rain over this last year or two that didn't come.
Well, she brought up a really good point there in the desert Southwest is they have a monsoon season that typically is during the summer months, and that's when they get a lot of rain and thunderstorms, sometimes on a daily basis. But as she mentioned, that monsoon basically didn't happen last year, practically speaking. I mean, in fact, it was actually called a nonsoon. You know, you put the N instead of the M for monsoon. So, you know, you put that in addition to what had been a dry winter, and now you're just hoping for a real monsoon to kick in place in the desert Southwest. And so these are some pretty nerve-wracking times for water managers in the Southwest.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking about drought conditions in Wisconsin and in the southwestern U.S. John Erdman is with us, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based here in Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the 2012 drought in Wisconsin? How does this one compare where you are? Do you have a firsthand field report from us, from your field or your garden or lawn or river or lake? And do you have friends or family in the western U.S.? Are you there yourself? What are you seeing or hearing about that drought? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with weather.com senior meteorologist John Erdman about severe drought conditions in Wisconsin and in the southwestern United States. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, what you're seeing in your community. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest described the cause of the drought in the Midwest as, I believe it was a heat dome that was diverting the jet stream. And I'm wondering, so where is the jet stream going, and are there places on the continent that are getting flooded by extra rain now?
Great question, Tom. John, is our loss somebody else's gain, for better or worse, when it comes to rain?
Yeah, that is an excellent question, and indeed that usually is the case. In this particular case, the jet stream is diverted north into Canada, but they're not really the most excessive rain that's occurring anywhere in the country right now. Well, I should say over the last several weeks, really in the spring, has been down in Texas and Louisiana. Some of those areas have picked up, you know, over 15 to 20 inches more rain than they typically get in a spring. So places like New Orleans, Lake Charles, Louisiana, which was unfortunately battered by Hurricane Laura last year, and also in parts of coastal Texas, including Houston and Victoria, Texas. So, yeah, that often is the case. And what will happen is if this heat dome sets up over the Midwest, is that south of the heat dome, so this is a little hard for radio, but south of the heat dome, you can get these areas of low pressure over the south that just sit and spin for a while and just are stuck. There's nothing, there's no jet stream to kind of whisk them away. And as a result, they can get dumped with rather prolific rain, while at the same time, we're just praying for a few drops here.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. John, with climate change, a lot of the predictions over the years have been it may not be all drought, it may not be all flooding, but there's higher chances of extremes, whether it's extreme drought or extreme rainfall. Does climate change make droughts like the one in the Southwest in particular right now more likely?
Yeah, I think that's the way to place it, that it increases the odds. So in a warming planet, generally what we're seeing now is that the Arctic latitudes, the higher latitudes, are warming faster than the latitudes around Wisconsin and around the lower 48 states. So what that does is that tends to slow down the jet stream. And the jet stream is the mechanism that steers weather systems. So if you slow down the jet stream, systems tend to move slower. So that would contribute to, if you're in a wet pattern, you would get heavier rainfall more often. But then if you're in a pattern where you get this heat dome that's persisting for a longer period of time, that could mean droughts could persist longer and be more frequent. So it's kind of this dichotomy. You can have greater extremes. You can have a really wet pattern. Like, by the way, in 2019, Wisconsin had its wettest single year on record. So it's hard to believe, you know, we had the wettest year on record in 2019, and now we're dealing with a drought. So we could see more of these lurches from drought to heavy rain to drought to heavy rain more often. So it's almost kind of hard to draw an average between those extremes.
We're talking about drought in the United States. Here in Wisconsin, we've got a drought going. Out in the Southwest, they have big drought problems over a big area. John Erdman with us from weather.com. He's a senior meteorologist. You can join in. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about drought or an experience to share, a report from your neck of the woods, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to switch gears a little bit, though, John. We often call you about hurricanes, and I know you have your eye on the Atlantic all the time. What are you seeing out there? What are the thoughts on this year's hurricane season?
Well, that's right. You know, part of my job is covering hurricane season. It's a little, you know, I just didn't quite get over the last one yet. And now we had a short-lived tropical storm Bill, which is way up near the Canadian Maritimes, and it's going to fizzle pretty quickly. But now we are watching another system that we are expecting to develop into a tropical depression or storm in the western Gulf of Mexico that will spread more rain, believe it or not, for Texas and Louisiana and parts of the Deep South. As soon as Friday into the weekend. And if that becomes a storm, it'll be named Tropical Storm Claudette. So, you know, we just keep accentuating the precipitation extremes here. Places that absolutely don't want to see another drop of rain for a while could see some more heavy rain. So places like New Orleans and Lake Charles, Louisiana. Meanwhile, up here, we're just gonna hope that we can get into a weather pattern by sometime later next week. So, yeah, the hurricane season is getting off to yet another early start. We could already be at the sea storm by later this week.
Getting back to extremes, the most extreme drought again going on in the American Southwest. Now, you mentioned here in Wisconsin, we've got a decent shot at getting back to normal-ish if rainfall picks back up and the jet stream switches gears a little bit. What are the prospects, though, in the hard-hit American Southwest for relief from this drought anytime soon?
Well, again, the Southwest is complicated because it depends on, you know, are they going to get a normal monsoon? Are they going to get the normal, you know, July, August, early September daily thunderstorms that provide at least some rain for the deserts? Are they going to get that? Hard to tell at this point, you know, and then as we get into the winter season, are we going to see finally some decent mountain snow in the central and southern Rockies, the Wasatch of Utah and into the Sierra of California? So it's very much an open question, but I can tell you that if California has a third straight winter that's pretty dry, the hydrologic issues as far as water supply are concerned are going to be much worse at this time next year. So this is really a crucial winter for California and the desert Southwest to get those more normal snows that when they melt in the spring, they recharge the reservoirs.
And Hoover Dam, this is just kind of a symbolic thing. The water levels behind Hoover Dam built back in the 1930s, lowest recorded levels ever. I mean, it's just part of the story, but it seems like a big deal, John.
Yeah, if you've been to Vegas and you happen to take the tour to Hoover Dam, you've probably seen the bathtub ring from where the water was highest back I believe it was the 1980s, that now that it's receded, it looks like this whitish kind of bathtub ring around Lake Mead. And yeah, I mean, that has complicated issues there, water use issues. And again, we really need that mountain snowpack this coming winter to recharge the whole Colorado River Basin next winter. So we'll cross our fingers and hope it's a much wetter winter there.
And finally, John, I mean, the drought here in Wisconsin, and we had some what to me seemed like early hot weather, flirting with 90 in late May, early June. I don't support that. I want to wait till August for my 90s. Is it going to keep being, was it in fact overall hotter than usual so far this summer? And is it expected to remain so?
Yeah, it's not your imagination. It was, in fact, the hottest first 2 weeks of June on record in Milwaukee, dating to the late 1800s. And it was by far the longest. So it was more typical of a mid to late July heat. Again, in the short term, there's some good news. We've got a really strong cool front that's going to plunge through Wisconsin early next week. So that'll pretty much knock the temperatures down to the 60s in the north and 70s in the south for early next week. But again, I think overall, we're probably looking at a pretty hot July and August. Unfortunately, that's kind of the way the pattern is setting up.
Huh. All right, John, thanks for joining us again. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's John Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He joined us for a look at drought here in Wisconsin and the really big drought going on right now in the American Southwest. If you have observations to share wherever you are, if you're experiencing drought, let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. Send pictures if they're relevant. Now, there's a big controversy in the medical community over the Food and Drug Administration's recent approval of a new Alzheimer's treatment drug. It's called aducanumab. It's the first. The disease itself. Patient advocacy groups have been pushing hard for the drug's approval. The Alzheimer's Association says when you consider what patients go through, they deserve the right to try the new treatment. But it's not clear whether aducanumab actually works. Results of the two main trials contradicted each other. So some doctors are saying the drug shouldn't have been approved. They're also worried about the bar being set too low for prescription drugs down the road. Got two doctors today set to weigh in on the matter. First, Dr. Andrew Budson is Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, a School of Medicine Professor of Neurology and Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. He's the author of 7 Steps to Managing Your Memory, What's Normal, What's Not, and What to Do About It. I talked to him earlier today.
Can you explain how, at least in theory, best case scenario, how this medication, aducanumab, works?
Yeah, so it is a monoclonal antibody made in a laboratory that is engineered to stick to the amyloid plaques that cause Alzheimer's disease. So antibodies are normally what our body makes to fight off infections like viruses and bacteria. But this is an antibody that's been engineered to stick to these amyloid plaques. And we believe what the sort of standard explanation of Alzheimer's has been for more than 20 years is that the amyloid plaques start the disease process. And then after that, the brain cells begin to be damaged and killed and cause trouble with thinking and memory. So in theory, if the drug works, and if our theories are correct, then this drug that has been clearly shown to remove amyloid plaques from the brain would slow down the progression of Alzheimer's.
That theory, though, is not locked down, as I understand it. Removing these amyloid plaques doesn't necessarily slow cognitive decline. Do I have that right?
You have that perfectly correct. And there have been other drugs that have also been shown to remove the amyloid plaques, but there has never yet, and it's unfortunate that I have to say, and still, there's never been proof that the cognitive decline has truly been slowed down.
Before we get into the trials on this particular drug, big picture, it's easy to understand why people would be excited, right? We just don't have anything in our toolkit that is going to do this, that's going to slow that cognitive decline.
Absolutely. The drugs that we do have available are good, and I prescribe them, and I want your listeners to know that, you know, that these are good medications. But the best case scenario, what the FDA-approved drugs before aducanumab can do is they can turn back the clock on memory loss by 6 to 12 months. So that's not bad, but it cannot stop the clock from ticking down. And in fact, the clock ticks down at the same rate. So if this aducanumab does everything that we hope it will do, it will actually slow down the slope, slow down the rate of progression, which nothing before has been proven to do.
Talking to Dr. Andrew Budson with the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, looking at this newly approved medication from the FDA, aducanumab, and why a lot of doctors aren't jumping for joy just yet on this. Can you take us, Dr. Budson, into these trials and the results they gave us? And there were kind of different results from one trial to another.
That's exactly right. So the trial involved a intravenous infusion every 4 weeks. And the goal is to not only remove the amyloid plaques, but also to slow down the thinking and memory problems. In two large studies, one of these studies at the high dose was successful in doing this. But the other large study at the high dose was not. And in fact, the placebo group came out a little bit better. So what the FDA advisory panel concluded, and what I personally agree with, is that you had one trial that was positive, you had an equally large trial that was negative, and we simply do not know whether the drug works or not. We need at least a third trial, a tiebreaker trial, to be able to figure it out, whether or not the drug works.
I think there's a mindset, a very understandable one among lay people, that goes along with ideas like the right to try movement, that says, hey, if we don't have anything in this drug category, isn't a maybe it's going to be successful better than we've got nothing at all? So why not put it out there?
So that's a good point, but the reason why not is that the drug is not without side effects. So approximately 40% of people who took the drug, 30 to 40%, had side effects of brain swelling. And if you have just a little bit of brain swelling, it's probably not a big deal. But if the brain swelling is horrendous, and that can happen, and I have seen that in some of the research I've been involved with, then the brain swelling can cause strokes, leading to permanent damage in the brain. The other known side effect is that more than 10% of people had these little, tiny, small hemorrhages. We call them micro hemorrhages. And that is another thing that you have one or two, probably not a big deal. But if you have, you know, tens or hundreds, that's not good for the brain. A little tiny bleed is really a little tiny small stroke. And so the last thing I want to do to my patients is to cause them brain swelling and cause them brain bleeding. So that's one reason that I feel we need to be cautious, even if people say, like, I want to take this medicine. Well, it's like, well, hold on. You got to understand the side effects.
What kind of research and what kind of research outcomes would you want to see before you felt comfortable seeing this drug approved and supplying it to your own patients?
I think the simple thing to do, if the company believes that the study that they designed, these two large phase three clinical studies, were designed correctly and used the right outcome measures, they should just repeat it, just do it again. And that would make me feel much more comfortable about recommending it or prescribing it to my patients.
Do you think the FDA made a mistake by giving it this approval?
Yeah, I do. I do think that they made a mistake. I think that, number one, I think it's a clear mistake just based on my own analysis of the data. I will also say, just like the FDA advisory panel did, that the FDA's own statisticians, their own people, thought that the drug was not proven to be beneficial. I also think it's a mistake for the FDA to go against the advice of their advisory panel, particularly when their advisory panel was essentially unanimous, saying that the drug should not yet be approved. And the last reason that I think the FDA made a mistake is that the potentially they are reducing the number of people who will want to enroll in a clinical trial in the future. People who might have enrolled in a clinical trial may now say, you know, why should I enroll in a clinical trial where half the people get the real drug and half the people get placebo if there's an approved FDA drug that slows down the disease? I want to just go for that. So the worry is it could potentially slow down the development of future research of products that really work unequivocally well.
And I wanted to ask you about that. Do you know of other medications in the pipeline that seem promising pending further research?
Yes. So if there is any sort of good news on the Alzheimer's front overall, it's that there has actually never been a time in the history of Alzheimer's disease when there are so many new treatments that are being developed. Some of them use the same approach as aducanumab, which is using antibodies to remove amyloid plaques. Other approaches use antibodies to remove the other major pathology in Alzheimer's, which are these tangles made up of tau. And so that might work. And yet there's even newer trials that are working on modifying the microbiome of the gut to see if that could be helpful. There's trials that, believe it or not, use flashing lights and sounds to induce a certain brain rhythm that could potentially be beneficial. And there's also new medications that are trying to tweak up or down neurotransmitters to improve patients' function and reduce their behaviors.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Andrew Budson, Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, School of Medicine Professor of Neurology and Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. Talk to him about the FDA's controversial approval of the Alzheimer's treatment drug aducanumab. We'll get another medical take coming up, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this drug, why it was approved, why so many have questions about it? Are you hopeful for this drug for you, maybe, or a family member? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on the FDA approval of the Alzheimer's treatment drug aducanumab, first new Alzheimer's treatment in nearly 20 years, raising hopes but concerns from a lot of doctors who say the trial results are so mixed that nobody can be sure it actually works, especially given possible side effects. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a reaction or a question for our guest. Matthew Schrag is a board-certified vascular neurologist and assistant professor of neurology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He's also a collaborator with the Vanderbilt Memory and Aging Project and an investigator in the Vanderbilt Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Dr. Schrag, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. I'm pleased to be here.
What is your reaction to the FDA approval of this drug, aducanumab?
Well, I think we've been concerned about this drug for some time. You know, the process of development of aducanumab through its two phase three trials has been quite a saga. And a lot of ups and downs and twists and turns. And I think this is yet another twist that I think has, you know, we've met with a great deal of skepticism. So we're concerned about what this drug is going to, the impact this drug is going to have on our patients and on the quality of the data that we have to evaluate the usefulness of this drug.
And Dr. Schrag, given the approval now, how confident would you be in prescribing this to a patient?
Well, I think that there are certain classes of patients with Alzheimer's disease who are clearly not candidates for this medication. And so there are some patients for whom the answer is very straightforward, that this is just not a safe treatment. But for patients who fit the criteria that were used in these clinical trials, specifically patients with early stage disease who don't have a history of major vascular problems, it's a much tougher conversation. Personally, this is not a drug that I would ever be enthusiastic about prescribing with the current state of the data. But I think it's a conversation that you have to have with individual patients, and patients and families are going to get a vote and need to understand the risks and the benefits and the limitations of the quality of our data. I think we have to present this to patients like it is an experimental treatment, because I think that's the stage we are still in.
Yeah, what would you say to that that family and that patient who are in that group where it's not a solid no? What kind of things would you do for, on the one hand, on the other hand?
Yeah, I think I have been impressed over the course of my career by the sophistication of our patients from all sorts of different backgrounds. And I think that what you do is you show them the data. You show them the two big clinical trials that came to conflicting results. And you ask, you know, them to consider that data. And specifically, and I think that this is the surprise to many people, I think many people say that, well, there was a good outcome and there was a bad outcome. But even if you take the most generous interpretation of the results and focus only on that good trial, the potential benefits were exceedingly small. They were measurable. They met statistical significance, but they were a very small clinical benefit. When we evaluate that for patients in clinic, we often administer a 30-point test that involves questions like, do you know where you are and what the date is, and answer some brain teasers and that sort of thing. The difference between the placebo group and the group that got the high dose of aducanumab was, in round numbers, about one half of one question. It was a very, very small benefit, even in the best of the trials. And I think patients have got to understand that. This is a medication that does not give people their memory back.
Let's bring on a caller now. Philip is with us in Neenah. Philip, hi.
Hi. I just have a question for the guest. I'm wondering whether, given the low efficacy shown in the trial, do we think insurance companies will pay for part or all of the treatment?
Interesting question, Philip, and an important question. I think I've seen numbers like $50,000 a year for a course of treatment, Dr. Schrag.
Yeah, Philip, I think that that's also a really important question. I think medications that are very, very expensive, we should expect a pretty substantial efficacy from that. I think a lot of these questions we're still waiting for definitive answers on, and they're conversations that we're having on a regular basis. I think there isn't certainty that all payers are going to pay for that. And I think that the big question is whether Medicare is going to pay for that, and we just don't know the answer yet.
Philip, thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Matthew Schrag from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, looking at aducanumab, a drug just approved by the FDA, but a lot of physicians concerned about that approval, saying the benefits are limited, the potential side effects are high. More research, at least, a lot of doctors are saying, including our guest, more research needed. Dr. Schrag, what is it about Alzheimer's that makes it such a tough target when we're looking for pharmaceutical or I guess, any treatment?
I think that's absolutely the right question, and it's something that we as a field have been struggling with for decades. And there are several definite answers to it. One is that not all Alzheimer's disease is the same. There are patients who have more or less vascular involvement, and patients where the pathology just looks different. So there's a heterogeneity among our patient population. The other problem, which has improved recently, is that the diagnostic tests previously were completely inadequate. It basically took an autopsy to get a conclusive diagnosis. And one of the biggest breakthroughs in this field in the last couple of decades, we're now able to use advanced scans to detect beta amyloid in the brain, and now even the tau protein in the brain, and we can make fairly confident diagnoses when people are still alive. And that's one of the tools that the clinical trials that Biogen conducted leveraged. They used PET scans to identify the beta amyloid pathology in the brain. And what surprised me a great deal about the FDA's approval is that they did not require the same testing for patients to get this on the open market. So patients may be considering taking this and not even have beta amyloid in the brain. And I think that's worrisome.
Given that this is such a hard condition to treat, do we know much about prevention, whether it's lifestyle or whatever else that's going to lower our odds of developing Alzheimer's in the first place?
You know, that may be one of the brightest spots on the landscape of the clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease. You know, most of the clinical trials over the last several decades have failed, and it's led to a lot of pessimism. But a clinical trial that looked at aggressive blood pressure control seemed, particularly in the early stages of cognitive symptoms, to make a substantial difference. And so we know really paying attention to your blood pressure, keeping your blood vessels healthy, seems to make a difference. There's also emerging data that avoiding social isolation can make a difference, and staying physically active throughout your adult life seems to be very protective. So all those things that you were told to do seem to be good ideas for your cognitive health.
Right. I've heard this a few times from different experts. A lot of the things we do to take care of our heart, for example, our lungs, our social well-being, might also help with Alzheimer's and maybe even other forms of dementia. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say. I think it's one of the things that we try to emphasize in our clinic here at Vanderbilt, is to help people stay engaged with their neighbors and stay physically active. That people who are healthy in other domains just seem to do better when they're confronting Alzheimer's disease.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dr. Schreck, if it isn't this drug, aducanumab, are you hopeful that we might see treatments in the next 5-10 years that might make a bigger difference?
I certainly hope so. The field, I think, was beginning to contemplate a reorganization. And Albert, we were taking the time to focus on new drug targets. And I hope that this approval doesn't change that recalibration. I think that it's time for us to consider what other parts of this disease might be targetable with drugs and invest in novel, new ideas. What I'm concerned about is that this approval may lead to the vast majority of the resources going to developing other similar anti-amyloid therapies. And I think that we've spent the last several decades working on this line without a lot of productivity. And so I certainly hope to see continued investment in some of these alternative targets.
Dr. Schreck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Matthew Schreck, board-certified vascular neurologist and an assistant professor of neurology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. We talked about the Alzheimer's drug aducanumab and his concerns about the FDA's approval of it last week. We also heard earlier from Dr. Andrew Budson from Boston University.